Adventurous Audio. From idea to ear, we make audio an adventure.
Illustrated London News, December the 9th, 1893. The old Lament murder trial in Scotland. The trial that's to begin on Tuesday next of Alfred John Monson for the attempted and for the actual murder of Windsor Dudley Cecil Ambrose will certainly be one of the celebrated criminal cases of the century. It possesses almost every possible element of interest.
On the 10th of August, 1893, Cecil Hambra was killed in a shooting incident. Alfred John Monson was arrested shortly afterwards and indicted on a murder charge, along with another man known as Scott, although he went by several names. Scott disappeared and a warrant was issued for his arrest. Meanwhile, the investigation continued into the curious relationship between Monson and Hambra, the victim. So why might Monson want to murder Cecil Hambra? I'm Penny Stewart. This is Inside Forensic Science, the Ard Lamont Mystery, Episode 4, The Motive.
The dead man, boy, one might almost say, since he would not have come of age till next year, was one to whom nature and fortune were lavish. It hardly seems over fanciful to suggest that destiny was severe to him in order to correct their prodigality. He was a tall, strong, well-built youth, over 6 feet in height, whose face had beauty of the Saxon type, straight, firm features, blue eyes with a charming individuality from their dark lashes, and a broad forehead crowned with golden hair.
The victim, 20-year-old Cecil Hambra, came from a supposedly moneyed and well-connected family. They had properties in Northamptonshire and on the Isle of Wight. The Hambras had been wealthy, particularly Cecil's great-grandfather. But Cecil's dad, Major Hambra, had squandered his money, and the family was effectively broke, although still living the life of the gentry on borrowed money, including young Cecil.
He was full of gaiety and popular everywhere. He rejoiced in every form of manly sport and was intensely fond of his horses and dog. Young Ambra was of such stuff as splendid soldiers are made on, and his parents chose for him a military career.
And with that military career in mind, Major Hambra, Cecil's dad, went in search of a tutor for him, which is where Monson comes into the story.
I first became acquainted with Alfred John Monson in May or June 1890. I was introduced to him by Mr. Tottenham. At that time, my son Cecil would be about 17 years of age. He was introduced to me as an army tutor. At that time, I was in financial difficulties. The introduction to Monson was made with a view to my son going to him to be trained for the army. I heard that Monson had been successful as an army tutor, and he showed me some testimonials which I thought were satisfactory. I did not know any of the men he had coached, and I made inquiries as regards his family. I was quite satisfied with his testimonials. The arrangement with Monson was that he was to keep and educate my son and prepare him for the army, and that he should receive board at the rate of £300 a year when my financial arrangements were made.
And I'm guessing that by financial arrangements, the Major meant when he was in less of a financial pickle, which he never was. So it's worth noting that Monson never got a penny. Nonetheless, off Hambra Jr. goes to live with Monson and his family. In the newspaper reports, Cecil is described as guileless for his age and a simple-minded lad. Whether that's true or not, I've no idea. But he does seem to have been highly influenced by the Monsons.
After young Hambra came into the hands of Mr. Monson and his wife, whatever may be the rights or wrongs of the case, it is certain that serious troubles began. The influence of the tutor and Mrs. Monson prevailed against that of the lad's parents, and he grew sadly estranged from them and visited them but rarely. Moreover, he became very extravagant, and money had to be raised for him, or at least by him, in all possible and undesirable ways.
I made a great effort to get my son to leave Monson and return to me. I found that Monson had undoubtedly acquired an influence over my son. I met Cecil occasionally and told him repeatedly of my desire that he should leave Monson and return to his family until I had other plans for him. I found Monson's influence operating against my advice to the boy, and had often great difficulty in getting him to meet me when I desired him to do so in London.
The cause of all these concerns, 32-year-old Alfred John Monson, was pretty high-born in his own right. His mother was the Honourable Caroline Isabella Monckton, daughter of the 5th Viscount Galway, and his dad was the Reverend Thomas John Monson. Alfred graduated from Oxford University and made a good marriage to Agnes Maud Day in 1881. Despite this seemingly good background and Oxford education, Monson was in serious financial trouble. Whenever the creditors arrived, Monson and his wife had a habit of absconding. Plus, there was a small issue of an insurance fraud concerning a school Monson once owned going up in flames. In August 1892, a year before Hamborough met his death, Monson was declared bankrupt. According to the accountant dealing with the bankruptcy, Monson had just half a crown in his bank account. So, we have two families, both bankrupt, both living beyond their means. In between them, we have young Cecil, who, on his 21st birthday, remember, at his death he was only 20, is due to inherit a fortune, £200,000. In today's money, that would make him seriously wealthy, a multi-millionaire. Let's return to Ard Lamont, where Cecil died. Monson and his family moved into the Ard Lamont estate in the summer of 1893, leasing the estate in Cecil's name, with a view to his purchasing it once he came into his inheritance the following year. As we've heard, Cecil died in a hunting incident on the 10th of August. At first, his death was certified as accidental. Then, on the 23rd of August, two officials of the Mutual Life Insurance Company came to Ard Lamont concerning an application which had been made for the payment of two life insurance policies for £10,000 each against Cecil Hambra's life. Life insurance. In a nutshell, you take out a policy, which means if a particular person dies, you get a payout. It turned out the Monsons had insured Cecil's life for £20,000 only days before he died, the beneficiary being Mrs. Monson. And Monson was inquiring about how to claim the money before Cecil was even in the ground.
J.G. McLean, I am the district manager of the Mutual Life Insurance Company of New York. All that Mr. Monson said about claiming the insurance money was to ask how he would go about the claim. I said that when the funeral was over, we would arrange that. On the following Monday, 21st of August, I saw Monson again at our office when he called to talk over the claim. I told him that we should require evidence of the death before we could discuss it. We had the doctor's certificate already, but still required evidence of the death from the fiscal.
The procurator fiscal smelt a rat, and within a week, Monson was arrested and charged with Hambra's murder. Let's have a quick recap. Major Hambra is skint. Monson is skint. Young Cecil Hambra is also skint, but due to come into a fortune. Everyone is agreed that the Monsons are owed money for looking after Cecil. So the Monsons have taken out life insurance on Cecil just in case he pops his clogs before they get their hands on their dosh. Now, I've only given you the bare bones, broad brushstrokes version of events. The trial papers go into Monson and Hambra's financial affairs in minute detail, and there's little doubt there is a complicated financial web being woven between the two families. If you have a head for figures, then you'll find a link to the trial papers in the show notes. Despite being super complicated, the financial element of this case is incredibly important when it comes to deciding whether Monson had a motive to murder Cecil.
So if you don't get the motive right, in this case it's the financials, if you don't get that right, you've probably not got a homicide.
Elizabeth Knowledge is a detective sergeant from the Financial Investigation Unit based at the Scottish Crime Campus. We asked Liz to cast an expert eye over the case for us.
So when I first had a look at it, I mean, it didn't take too long to assess there's absolutely something rotten in the state of Denmark with the personal finances of this accused, and also his over-involvement with the finances of the deceased and his family. But ultimately, I mean, a bad smell does not a case make. You must break it down. And although it appears obvious that a fraudulent scheme has been undertaken, it must be evidenced.
So you've got a whiff of fraud going on here. Fraud in what way?
So his financial position, for instance, he really is in his uppers, him and his wife, despite being born into quite a well-to-do family. As I say, he's educated, but they seem to be robbing Peter to pay Paul. That's what it looks like to me. As I said, he is a bankrupt. There is a whiff of a history about insurance fraud here, something about a school burning down. And he appears to be in the business of creating a sort of persona for himself, involving himself in the purchase of the estate and their yacht. These are quite high-profile items that would give him even more air of authority and wealth. And the way that he appears to have manipulated the deceased, who was just a young man, he's gone to great effort, and in actual fact, a few of the financial houses have caught him out and have refused his application for life insurance.
The sketch, 13th of December. It appears that during this and last year, there were no less than 7 proposals for insurance on the boy, Hambra's life, amounting to 93,000. Of this, 58,000 was made nominally on behalf of Mrs. Monson and 15,000 in the name of Mr. Monson.
As you go through the trial papers, the number of times the Monsons have tried and failed to take out insurance on Cecil's life is certainly striking. James Wardle from the Leeds branch of the Liverpool, London and Globe Insurance Company received an application for £15,000 on the 28th of May. David Stewart of the Liverpool, London and Globe Insurance Company received a proposal via letter on the 20th of July for insurance on Hambra's life amounting to £50,000. William Wisley, secretary of the Scottish Provident Institution, received a letter on the 11th of July for insurance of £10,000.
It is very highly suspicious for him to claim to have an interest in the young fellow's life as well, when he wasn't even a family member, although he is purporting to be his guardian. But it looks to me as they're trying to act as a sort of stand-in parent and almost guardian to have some sort of legal authority over him and some sort of claim. And I think their influence is such as young Cecil probably feels he's in on it and knows what their plans are, but they've probably bedazzled him with the amount of detail and confused him. So he's probably thought he knew what he was getting into, but ultimately, did he?
It's impossible to know exactly what Cecil Hambra thought. He certainly knew about the various attempts to take out life assurance policies in his name.
It is said that there are documents in existence in Lieutenant Hambra's handwriting clearly expressing the attention that Mrs. Monson should, in the event of his death, benefit to the full extent of the amount insured.
Dear sir, I am requested by Mrs. Agnes Maud Monson to write to inform you that she has an interest in my life to the extent of £26,000. I have given her an undertaking to pay her this sum on my attaining 21, if I should live until then. Yours truly, signed W.D.C. Hambra.
So it looks to me like the couple, and that's another element, Mrs. Monson was never an accused. It looks to me like both of them are trying to almost parent him, take responsibility for him, and ultimately, should anything happen to him, benefit.
So they were trying to take out life assurance policies, or they did take out life assurance policies on his life.
Yes.
I found that quite odd. I mean, how easy is it just to take out a life assurance policy on somebody else?
Well, it's not easy, and you wouldn't be able to do that today either. Again, similar, you would have to show the strong relationship and why you would have an interest. And you see him doing that. He tries and tries again, and he's using workarounds, and the story changes slightly each time, and the amount of cash changes each time. I think he realises he's pitched way too high in the beginning, and then the sum comes down and down and down, but the story slightly changes each time.
In fairness to the Monsons, they've never been paid for Cecil's tutoring or accommodation. And the deal always was that they would get their money once Cecil came into his inheritance. So they are owed by the Hambras. Various witness accounts from the trial seem to suggest that Hambra and Monson have a good and close relationship, and that Monson seemed genuinely upset by Hambra's death.
John Stephen. I often saw Mr. Hambra and Monson together, and they seemed to be on the best of terms. When I returned to the house and saw Monson in the smoking room, he seemed to feel very vexed. I noticed that he was affected. He was crying. He seemed to be too distressed to give any particular directions about what should be done with the body.
When I saw Monson in the smoking room after the death, he seemed very much excited and distressed. He was scarcely able to speak.
As we've heard, after many failed attempts, the Monsons did finally manage to take out two life insurance policies on Cecil in the week before he died. But when they come to make a claim, they hit a snag. Because Hambra hasn't reached the age of 21, the policies are invalid. What's not terribly clear is whether the Monsons knew that Hambra's age would mean they couldn't cash in the policies when he died.
But I did wonder if Mr. Monson understood it to be the case in Scotland, if that could potentially be a reason why they decamped to Scotland. Did he think there were different rules applied for guardianship and the fact that the deceased was a minor in Scotland, and that should have been bottomed out? Much was made that, well, Mr. Monson knew he was a minor and it had to be his parents and would never have got anyone anyway. It certainly didn't stop him having a go, and he has had a go, and that's what's happened here. So for me, that's a moot point, whether he would have or wouldn't have got the money. He had a go at it. He made a good attempt to get at it. So for whatever reason, that I don't think was brought out enough or emphasised enough. I think there was too many other things and too much information flying around for the jury perhaps to really grasp that he's had a good go at it. Anyway, regardless, he's thought he was entitled and he was effectively going to chance his arm to get the money.
If your head is already bouncing with all this, spare a thought for the poor jury who sat through hours and hours of financial details relating to mortgages and premiums and life insurances and entails. Don't get me started on entails. I started Googling that and ended up down a rabbit hole Alice in Wonderland would have been impressed with. Even Ashley Edwards KC, who's used to dealing with trial papers, found it confusing.
As I was reading the transcript, and that's before I looked at the actual report of the case, I kept thinking, why are we doing this? Yes, it might be quite simple to construct the motive, but you don't have to do it in such great detail. It would be really quite simple to lead maybe one or two witnesses which would set out the picture that the Crown were wanting. And I couldn't understand why the evidence went into such great detail about the entail and all the different stories about the insurance and all the different ways that they were going to raise money through the insurance. That was quite detailed, and I think that, again, that would be very difficult for the jury to follow. But I was also thinking, why is this admissible? Because some of it did seem to be a crime not charged. And that, of course, we're not allowed to lead evidence of a crime not charged. If we're going to lead evidence of a particular crime, then the accused must get notice of that, and it's usually included in the indictment. And here there wasn't that. There was simply two charges, one an attempted murder and one a murder.
I got fairly cross-eyed with the level of detail with the financial stuff. I'm not convinced yet that I understand what went on. No. And who was trying to do what to whom, in the name of what.
Yeah, it was all very complex, and I think you really have to understand, and I don't understand it fully. I've heard it mentioned before, and I've done it at university, but it's the law of entails, and I think that's quite a complex area of the law. I saw in one of the court report, or one of the newspaper reports, that there was a suggestion that he was, that the deceased was to inherit £200,000 at age 21. I didn't see that in the evidence that was laid in court. I saw some income from the various different estates, which might have totaled in 10, 12, 13,000. I think the figure 7,000 and 4,000 was mentioned, but I didn't see anywhere the full value of 200,000 mentioned. Now, that might have been the value of the various estates, but I don't think he had an entitlement to sell the various capital assets. So I found that quite difficult to follow.
Yeah, I hear you. If Ashley Edwards can't follow it, what hope have we?
So for me, Mr. Monson is what I would call a confidence trickster. So that's a certain type of criminal, and it's more about psychological tactics that are deployed to victims and witnesses alike. And for me, it sounds like young Cecil has been groomed. The grooming of victims can take place over several years, and that can actually hinder investigators, so because they've got a degree of influence and control. So the focus of that type of investigation can't just be about a paper trail or financial documentation or to follow the money, so to speak. You need to evidence the human behaviour and the backstory of the players involved. And for me, the deceased appears to be manipulated as a cash cow or a potential cash cow for Monson. So analogy I would draw, it's a bit like romance fraud, where someone can be groomed and bamboozled over months or even years. They're bombarded with messages, they're bombarded with sob stories about why the person in another country might need the money, and quite often it's something like plane tickets or a bank account frozen. And that was actually what sprung to my mind in this case, that young Cecil might have just been so taken in by Mr. Monson that actually he try and talk him out of it and make him understand, you know, you're potentially going to be a victim of a serious crime here, might actually have been very, very difficult. Somebody once said fraud's the only crime where you need to convince someone they've been a victim or they are a victim. And that rings true for me in this case.
Liz Knowledge makes a compelling argument about Cecil being groomed. If he was, perhaps unsurprisingly, he certainly doesn't sound to have been aware of it.
My dear father, I am truly sorry if I have added to your troubles, and can only say that I had no intention of doing so. I think you greatly mistake Mr. Monson's intentions. I am sure that he has not misrepresented things to me, and I cannot see what nefarious ends he has in view. He has always been straightforward to me.
A strong case is made by Mr. Comrie Thompson for the defence during the trial that the Monsons are financially dependent on Cecil Hambra. He's the one who's paying the bills, with money borrowed against his future income.
Now, what is the evidence about motive in this case? I admit at once that at times, and generally, Mr. Monson and his family were not well off, that they were reduced sometimes to straits which involved them in doing what is always indicative of impecuniousness, pawning ornaments and other small articles. You will notice as a fair and obvious observation arising from the state of matters that by killing Cecil Hambra, Mr. Monson at once deprived himself of his only fixed source of income. Because the charge amounts to this: that the prisoner killed a man upon whose life his income and subsistence depended. There's his motive.
If Hambra was the cash cow, and Monson had recognised that and groomed him in some way, why would he go and kill the cow?
A potential motive might be that he thought he could cash in there and then, and he was under such extreme financial pressure that he struck then and didn't wait till the lad turned 21.
So you think it was just greed and urgency, potentially, on Monson's part, that he thought, if I cash in now, at least I'll get 20 grand?
Potentially. Because, again, do we fully understand his financial position? There could be other elements we don't know anything about because the full background hasn't been explored.
So what do you think actually happened here?
I think something has gone badly wrong at the estate. I think the timing of it is key. I don't think we know the whole story as to why what happened to poor Cecil happened on that date. I think there is a lot more information and evidence out there. But certainly, ballistics aside, and what may or may not have happened with the shooting accident, there is definitely, to me, looks like a crime has been committed in terms of fraud or a fraudulent scheme here, perhaps with forgery as well at hand there. And that, for me, looks like an escalation of previous behaviour by Mr. Monson. This is a whole new ball game. This is a young man that was due to inherit £200,000. In modern day, that is millions and millions of pounds. So it's as if he started perhaps a bit smaller, with smaller insurance frauds. And then he has been introduced to the Hambra family and we are where we are now.
So, red flags. Tell me, what were the red flags for you that something fraudulent was going on here?
Okay, so for me, looking at it, the accused Monson, he appears to be a fine purveyor of what I would call flim-flam and fraudulent speak. He's clearly very educated. He's a graduate from Oxford University, so he is not a typical suspect. So he's clearly clever and he clearly puts a great deal of effort and time into infiltrating this family and their finances. So really you've got to match that energy and effort that he's putting in, because if you don't, you'll fall behind. And I think that's what's happened with the prosecution in this case. If you think of it in terms, this appears to be his job. It's his bread and butter. He is doing this day in, day out and infiltrating this family. He's all over their finances, despite the fact he's penniless himself and a discharged bankrupt. He's all over their finances. His tentacles are far and wide as to get a grip. And you can tell by the amount of evidence presented at the case. So there's 241 productions presented in this case. The vast majority of them were documents and financial related documents. So he's been busy. So you would have to match that and you'd have to leave no stone unturned.
To my lay ear, I thought 241 productions sounded like a fair chunk of financial evidence. But Liz clearly thinks this case was rushed to court. So what time would it take to bring a case like this to court nowadays?
It would take as long as it took, okay, till you get sufficiency of evidence. It is not unknown for complex fraud cases to take several years, depending on the amount of witnesses involved, the jurisdictions, the amount of accused. Cases that involve businesses or organisations do tend to take a bit longer. Cases that just involve perhaps one person for one embezzlement in a very, very small company could be a lot quicker, but there would still be a great deal of work would need doing before that. You would have to get warrants or production orders, and they take a long time. They're not easy to get, and a lot of research would have to be done and evidence gathering for warrants to be granted.
So how would you go about all that?
So what we do, it's really through a process of research and analysis. So there is a certain amount of information available to anyone. We call it open source, where you can go online, you can read news stories about people, you can research organisations such as Companies House. You could research property sales, for instance, as well. So there is a plethora of information online that you could research, but some of the background information is only accessible in certain cases. You need certain authority, either under the Data Protection Act or through warrantry or production orders in the case of money laundering. So it is not straightforward to just build a financial profile. There's many, many different elements to it, and you need to go through it methodically to basically build a rich picture how someone is financially and their associations.
I'll leave it to you to decide whether you think the picture we have of Monson and his associates adds up to a motive for murder. But, as Mr. Comrie Thompson points out, motive alone does not a murder make.
While I grant there's a certain weight to be attached to motive, it does not take you very far. And if that is all that you have, it takes you no length whatsoever.
So even if Monson did have a motive, that isn't proof that he did it. For that, we need to turn back to explore the ballistics evidence.
For me, the major question is it possible that the wound was self-inflicted or not? And once you have the answer to that question, then that's the leap-off point for all the rest of the evidence.
Is it possible that the wound is self-inflicted or not? That's exactly what all the experts in the case set out to investigate. And it's just what Duncan and me are going to try and discover too in the next episode. The barrel of the gun is at most 2 feet away from you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's probably a bit closer than that because the whole height of the... I mean, the length of the gun is actually a lot longer than I realised it's going to be. A shotgun's tall.
Yeah.
Is that about 3 foot?
It's a big one. I'll just make sure it'll get a tip here.
So is it possible to prove that Hambra could or could not have shot himself? And where, oh, where is Scott?
The police are said to have ceased to search for the missing man, Scott, because they have ascertained that the mysterious individual who is not to be found was a woman in man's guise. This tale is only one of many wild guesses in connection with the mystery.
In episode 4 of the Ard Lamont mystery, the experts were Elizabeth Norledge, Ashley Edwards KC, and Duncan McKenzie. The actors were Pam McIntosh, Jake Lee, Alan Richardson, David Stewart, Yana Miller, Neil Wallace, Chris Dolan, and Joe Riley. Inside Forensic Science is written and presented by me, Penny Stewart. The story consultants and series researchers are Heather Duran and Clara Morris. The sound mix is by Steve Bull. Inside Forensic Science, the Ard Lamont mystery, is an adventurous audio production for the Leverhulme Research Centre for Forensic Science at the University of Dundee and is funded by the Leverhulme Trust.